Hello, everybody. This is Rob Fredette with the podcast HodgePod, and I have a guest tonight on my podcast, David Goyce. He's a criminologist from Bogota, Colombia, and we're going to be talking about his work as a criminologist and what he's been doing lately. He's been in the field for 15 years, but I'm going to let him tell you more about that. David, welcome to my podcast, HodgePod. You're in Bogota, Colombia, are you not?
I am in Bogota. Hi, Rob, and thanks for inviting me to your show.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. So first of all, what exactly is a criminologist and how is that applied to what you do? So if you could explain that, please.
Yes, that's an excellent question. And it's always funny the reactions that I get when I say that I'm a criminologist, because most people believe that I am some sort of CSI person who goes to the scene crime and tries to figure out what happened there. Well, that's not what I do. I am a criminologist, so that means that I try to understand why crime happens in society. Mm-hmm. I also try to understand why people, for instance, engage in crime. Why do a regular person end up committing some type of crime? I also try to understand what society can do about crime. How can we prevent it? We also study punishment. How does society punish crime? Does it work? Should we react in a different way? But I also study why do we label certain acts as criminal and not others? So, for instance, if we think about drugs, why do we say certain drugs are criminal or criminalized and not others? So what I have been doing for the past 15 years is to gather as much data, as much information as possible by interviewing people, by going to the field, by going to the prisons. And that's why I'm in Bogota now, because I was today in a prison. So I try to understand with evidence why does crime happen and what we can do about it.
Yes, and one thing I find really interesting sometimes when here in the States, when you watch the news, it's always like when a crime happens, it's always like a small amount of time of somebody's life, and then it defines something for the rest of their lives. So what are some of the things that you've, in your career as a criminologist, what have you seen, and maybe one or two instances where something goes wrong? So what would be like two items that really quick that if you could talk about?
Yes, that's an excellent point, what you have just said. So criminologists have identified the contacts with the police or the criminal justice system that can change the course of someone's life. So for instance, there's this young person who gets into a fight, and then the police comes, and then the person is sent to prison or to jail. And then from that moment on, even if that person had not committed any crime before, then he's always labeled as a criminal. And then many doors close because he has this label of criminal and he has this track record. And then when he's denied the opportunities, then he has to actually become a criminal or engage, kind of personify this role of a criminal. Because he has no other opportunities. So that's one of the things that can go wrong. This contact with the police, the criminal justice system, that can mark a person, that can kind of put on him this label of criminal. And something else, something that we have identified through these interviews, through these studies, is the importance of childhood and the importance of parents. Mm-hmm. So most of my interviewees, most of the people that I have met in prison, they have been abused by the parents. It may be physical violence, it may be just absent parents, it may be sexual abuse, and that really marks a person's life because that's what the person learns to do, to believe that behaving violently is the best way to get what you want.
So when you just said you were in a prison today in Bogota, so What do you have to do to actually get into the prison? Do you have to go through some sort of protocol to get access to the prisons? And how does that work and how long does it take?
Well, it varies a lot from country to country. So I have been visiting prisons throughout Latin America. I have also been in prisons in Norway where I live and work. And then there are many different bureaucracies, different cultures. So, for instance, in Colombia, I was in contact with the Penitentiary Institute, which are in charge of all prisons in Colombia. So they have two divisions. They have this school where they prepare those who are going to work as prison guards. So they have to give me an approval, but they also have to talk with the prison director, and I have to explain him what I want to do inside. So this is there are a couple of factors here. First, I have to have a good reason to go inside prison, because they won't just allow anyone. But there's also the human factor. They also need to know that I am trustworthy, that I want to do something that makes sense, mm-hmm. and that I am also trying to contribute to society in some way.
Hmm. So when you go into a prison, do you feel safe when you go in there and surrounded by prison guards when you're in the facility?
Well, no. And I think this is an excellent question, because many people worry, because I spend, as I said, many days and many hours inside prisons. And let me give you an example. I went to Bolivia last year. That was November. And I wanted to interview this specific person. And that specific person was the head of this violent criminal organization. So it's an organization that started in Brazil and has expanded throughout the continent, and now is starting in Bolivia. And he's the leader. So I always prefer to talk one-on-one with the people in prison, because that's the way to get them to trust in me. No, it would be, they would not tell me everything if there's a guard there, mm-hmm. because they would think that they are disclosing something that can be used against them. So I always ask the guards, don't come with me. I want to be alone with that person. And what happened is that person arrived to the interview. It was a classroom in the prison. I was sitting there alone, a small classroom, an old building. And he arrived with two guns and visibly carrying them. And he sat in front of me and he said, you know, I have killed 14 people in this prison inside. So that was some sort of projection of I am the boss here. And my reaction, and this is something that I have learned along these years, how to deal with people, was to say, well, if you want to kill me, you can kill me, but I am not your enemy. I'm here to talk with you, just like a human being, as we are two human beings talking together. So that is a short story to tell you. Well, I have not felt unsafe. I have never experienced any sort of danger. And I think that has to do maybe with the fact that I meet them, we see eye to eye, and I'm very open and very human. Mm-hmm. I know they are very human, and we have this very honest conversation. And I think that's a very human thing to do, to connect and to listen to someone, because we all want to be listened to.
That's an incredible story. So when you get access to the prisons and you go through the protocol, do you go back to the prisons repeat times to talk to inmates, and what's the some of the, I guess, the topics or the findings that you get when after you're done interviewing with them? That do they feel remorseful?
So yes, I interviewed the same person several times, and there's a reason for that. And the reason is that what you tell depends on the occasion and how much trust you have on the person you're talking with. So for instance, we meet now, we are kind of, you know, we know each other from before, but not that much. Then we meet again, and then we meet again, and there kind of the trust grows. So that's one of the reasons why I go repeatedly to visit them, because as they see me again and again and again, they know that I'm there to listen to them, that I'm not going to give kind of a snitch, and that I'm not going to pass on any information to the authorities, that I'm just there to listen genuinely, and it's only the information is only for me. So as they trust more and more, so they tell me more and more. But also, and this is interesting, because when we tell something to somebody, we are not always coherent. We are not always telling the same story. And that has to do with that we are always, or many times we have this internal conflict, tension. There's ambiguity in how we see life. So when I meet them several times, I get to capture that ambiguity. So as you were saying, do they feel guilty? Do they feel remorseful? Well, that varies in the same person. So some days, sometimes they feel guilty, remorseful. They said, I should not have done this. But other times, they are proud of what they have done. So it depends a little bit on what kind of day they have had, what kind of experiences. So for instance, if they are kind of feeling that their family is far away, that they are lonely, that they don't have friends, then they tend to feel remorseful and say, okay, I ruined my life. But if they wake up differently another day, they're very proud of what they have done. So that varies a lot, and that's why I meet them repeatedly. And the type of questions we ask, or that I ask when I'm in prison, it has to do with their life course. And the life course is this sequence of phases from childhood to adolescence to adulthood to their time in prison, because to understand why someone engages in crime, we have to look at the entire life course. So what happened in their childhoods? What happened in the adolescence? How come they are in there? And there are different findings. So we find, and this is a study that we have been conducting in Latin America, and I say we because I've been visiting many prisons, but I am part of a team. So I have also colleagues and friends who have also been visiting prisons. And what we have found is that poverty is one of the major reasons for people to start in crime. So another story that I can tell you here. There was this boy, he was 6 or 7. His father had left the family. His mother was trying to get some money, but kind of struggling. And he had 2 younger sisters, and they had nothing to eat. So he was 7. The neighbor came and said, if you do me this favor, and it was a sexual favor, I can give you this money. So the boy thought, well, we have nothing to eat. My sisters have nothing to eat. I want to do something for my family. So he did that on repeated occasions. And then he thought, well, if I got this money from the neighbor, maybe I can also get more money by doing the same from other people. So he started going to the streets, just, you know, this main street, and met people and started prostituting himself. And that's how he got in contact with the street. And when he was in the street, there were other people telling him, well, now that you're doing this, it's easier for you, for instance, to sell drugs. You're in the street already. There's a lot of people passing by. So you can also take the opportunity to sell drugs. And then he started selling drugs, and then he also learned how to rob them. So he started mugging people. So if you look at that example, that's how it started. Mm-hmm. He had no family to support him. He had no money. So that happened in the childhood. So that's perhaps one of the main findings, when the person is very vulnerable in the childhood, when the estate is not present, when the family cannot support him or her, then it's much more likely that the person will find a way to cover his or her needs.
Boy, that's that's just horrible. So as like you just the situation you just talked about, it just escalates into different types of crime, more severe, more types of crime that will escalate, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So what happens is that people also diversify. The streets are this place of confluences. So people engage in different types of crimes. So you have drug dealing. You also have, well, prostitution. It depends on the country if it's a crime and what type of actions criminalized related to it. But also stealing. But also starting doing other stuff, like learning how to commit fraud, for instance. So both the streets and prison are this school of crime, in a way, because people who need to make money, meet there, and they learn from each other. So it can escalate in different ways, and especially in particularly weak countries. So for instance, Colombia, it has kind of this trajectory of violence, of war, of poverty, inequality. So what we identified is that what usually leads a person into crime in countries like Colombia, with so much poverty, so much violence, can easily lead the same person into war, either for the guerrillas, for the paramilitaries. So it depends a lot on the context.
Have you had any interviewed any inmates who have had a success story getting out of prison and being a getting it back into society and being successful? Have you had any examples in your 15-year career?
I have not had those examples because usually I have been interviewing people engaged in drug trafficking. And in Latin America, due to the war on drugs, these crimes are punished very harshly. So they can get up to 25 years in prison. And that's more than I have been in the field. But I have colleagues who have had these success stories. And I also have a friend. And this is a fascinating story, because she is a model, she's an actress, she's a celebrity in Colombia. And she learned from her mother that those in prison are not bad people. They are just humans who went through something difficult, made mistakes, made sometimes horrendous things, but they are also human, and that we should be have compassion, try to help, have empathy. So this person who has, well, she's quite wealthy, she's famous, she has all the success, and she decided to help them. And she has this foundation. And she has had many success stories, to call it somehow, by giving them, and that's the name of her foundation, second opportunity, by giving them a second opportunity, mm-hmm. by trusting them, by telling them, I trust you. I know you're a human being. I know you made a mistake. But I'm here for you, and our foundation is here for you. Mm-hmm. And we cannot give you the money to start again, but we can give you the trust. And many times, that's what people need. Of course, people also need opportunities. They also need employment. But she gives them the trust and also some skills on how to start some startup or some way to make legal money.
Are you going back to any prisons this week? I know you said today you were in a prison in Bogota. Is this something that you do in a daily, or is this something you do in consecutive days where you go back? And then secondly, where do you, any findings that you get, who do you report these findings to report back to, like authorities or things? Do they listen, or are there criminologists like yourself that get together and put together a study?
So to the first question, it depends on what I'm doing at the moment. So we had a very intense period of visiting prisons to interview people. So when we do that, we go almost every day. Now I'm not going all that often, because what I'm doing now, we collected the life stories of 420 people in Latin America. And what we do with that is not only to record them, but we transcribe them, because that's an easier way to analyze their stories. So what I'm doing every day these days is to read through their stories and try to find patterns. What do they have in common? What can we understand about crime and criminality in general? Not just this one person, but many. So these days I'm going perhaps once a week, twice a week, because I'm doing another type of job. But it's always, you know, when you get in prison, inside a prison, it's always both, how can I put it, it's a heavy, heavy atmosphere, because it is confinement. So being inside a place every day for years, it gets heavy, and people are not all that happy all the time. But at the same time, so as I just said, I was there today and I was talking with them, and they were smiling and they were joking and they were enjoying the activity. So when I'm inside the prison, I have these mixed feelings. Both I feel the heaviness, but also the happiness of being in contact with another human being who smiles at you and who wants to talk with you. So that's the first question. And the second question, what we do is, and this is also a reason why I wanted to talk with you, Rob, and why I appreciate the invitation.
Nope. Yes, thank you.
Often, it's often that academics, we talk to each other, but we don't let the rest of society in our conversation. Mm-hmm. So most often what we do is we write scientific articles. We publish them in these specialized journals. We use a lot of jargon. We use many words that only us understand. And that's how we live. And that's, you know, a good life. You're a scholar. You do the research that you are interested in. You publish. You get to see your name on these prestigious journals. So that is part of what we're doing. But I also believe that it's very important for us to communicate our findings to the rest of society. Because especially when it comes to crime, there are many myths. There are many, it's a huge industry that sells many wrong ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to do now is to, for instance, talk with you, people who can spread the word. I'm also writing this narrative nonfiction book, which is more of a popular book. So what I'm doing in there is to tell the stories. Tell the stories of the people that I meet, tell the story of my journey throughout the continent, visiting prisons, to tell some anecdotes. And through those stories, I'm trying to convey what we criminologists have found to be the causes, to call it somehow, the causes of crime, why people commit crime. So most of us criminologists are just writing for each other, but another group of us are also trying to spread the word and telling society why does crime happen and what we can do to lessen its impacts and its frequency.
So let me ask you this: you've gone into prisons and you can leave. Do you ever feel confined when you're in there for that period of time? Do you feel confined? I find that to be interesting because you get to leave. Did you ever feel like it's confinement when you're in there?
In different ways, yes. So another anecdote of my trips throughout Latin America. I went to this prison in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. It's, to my knowledge, the largest prison in the continent. I think it has some 40,000 prisoners, and that's a lot of people.
30,000?
So almost 40,000. So you can imagine how big that prison is. And when I went to that prison, I had been in another prison in another region of Brazil, and the prison director told me the best clothes that you can wear when you come in are just jeans, blue jeans, and then a white t-shirt, and just sneakers, and mm-hmm. that's it. So that's kind of what I recommend you to wear. So I did that, and then when I was in Rio, I thought, okay, if that worked in that prison, then it should work in this prison. So I wore the same clothes, and when I arrived in the prison, one of the guards told me, that's the only clothes you have? Yes, that's the only clothes that I have. And he told me, well, you know, every inmate in this prison uses the exact same clothes in here. So when I went in, it was right. So all of them had blue jeans and mm-hmm. white t-shirt and sneakers. So I looked exactly like them. And to your question, I felt confined in different ways. First, because once I was inside a cell where I think it was some 40 people who slept in there, who lived in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a big cell, so it was very, very crowded. So I walked inside the cell to kind of looking at every corner, and then when I looked back, I saw there were these 40 persons looking at me, and I thought, if they wanted, they could just keep me in there, not let me leave, because they were many more, stronger. So in that moment, I thought, well, this is some sort of confinement. Mm-hmm. When you have no longer the power to leave the place you want, and you can feel the anguish of being in that situation. But second, at the same time, I also thought, I could be here, because they are exactly like me.
Mm-hmm.
They are, well, you know, I'm Latin American, I'm from Colombia, I'm not from a wealthy family, I'm from more of a middle-class family. Mm-hmm. And then I know that many of them had similar lives, similar trajectories to mine. So I thought, we're very similar, I could be here. So in that moment, I felt the empathy, and I felt I'm here, I'm wearing the exact same clothes, and I can feel how it feels. So that's the first part of my answer. But at the same time, no. Because I work at the University of Oslo, and that opens doors. And that also shows how the world and how society works. So if you say I'm from Colombia, from Latin America, then not that many doors open. But if you say I'm from Norway, I come from Norway, from this university, then all the doors open. So when I was in there, I knew that there were guards, that there were judges, there were people who were very attentive to my situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was protected. So I could never compare myself to a person in confinement, because I knew I could live. And that's part of what's tough in this research, that I get to go there, talk with them, I get their stories, but then I get to leave, and I have somehow taken something from them, because they have told me their stories. I get to write articles, I get to write books, but they are still in there, and I took their stories. So I have felt that confinement sometimes, but in the end, we're in very different situations.
Mm. And you said you're putting together a book, you're writing a book, nonfiction book?
I'm writing a book, and this is going to be, well, perhaps my second nonfiction book. So the last one, it was about the victims. And I think that's an interesting combination, because I have interviewed victims, and I have interviewed now also those who have committed the crimes. So I was interviewing the victims of Pablo Escobar. You may have heard of him, this famous Colombian drug lord, on whose life Narcos produced, Netflix produced Narcos. So that was the first slightly narrative nonfiction book. But now this one, with the title Humans Behind Bars, is my first 100% narrative nonfiction book, telling these stories of the people that I have met and of the journey that I have taken throughout Latin America.
So I got a question. Have you ever been to the States to interview inmates in prisons?
I have been to the States. I have been in prisons there, but I have never interviewed an inmate in there.
What's really amazing when you watch stories on television, it's like how does like that crime happen, or did this crime happen? It's really, it baffles my mind sometimes how something could happen just like in 1 minute. Everything's fine, and then like in 30 seconds something is gone sideways, and then a crime happens. I shake my head sometimes. And so how would you talk about that, like just something that a crime that happens, and again there's factors for it, but do people sometimes snap and that's it?
I don't think so. I don't think that happens, and that's what we get to see. Because we only get to see the top of the iceberg, in a way. We only get to notice the moment in which everything went wrong. Because that's what's more appealing to our sight, to our gaze. So when we see, I don't know, a murder, then we think, okay, why did this happen now? Just in the moment, someone snapped. But it's never the case. It's never the case in different ways. It's never the case that one person just snaps and decides to commit a crime. Because to understand that crime, we always have to look back into why did that person react that way? What's behind that? And most often, it's a trajectory of abuse, of victimization, of absent parents, of substance abuse, drug addiction, abuse of alcohol. So you can never understand a crime just by looking at the moment. And that's when it comes to the person committing the crime. But the same applies to the victim. It's never a random victim. So there are people who are most often victimized. And that's also what we have identified. There are people who are more more vulnerable to crime. So say that you are working, you have a job that requires you to be in the streets most of the time, then you are more prone to being a victim of a crime because you are more exposed. Whereas if you are this wealthy person who commutes in the car, in a more safe car, then you're more protected. So it's never, these encounters may seem random, but they are not random. It never happens that the person snaps. And that's what we criminologists try to do. Why does this happen? Why does crime happen? Why and does victimization happen? And who are most prone to being victimized and to committing crimes?
I've never heard it explained that way. That's fascinating. So somebody doesn't snap. It's the layers of things in their life that makes that person do that crime. That's so when you hear something, when somebody snapped, that's not because they snapped at that moment. There are some things leading up to it. I find that I've never heard it explained that way. That's really interesting. Let's talk about the victims. You said you've talked to victims. What is the, it's horrible that the victims have to live with the tragedy, but what did you learn from talking to victims of crimes in your studies or your interviews?
The first thing that I learned is, again, that victimization is unevenly distributed in society. So people who live in impoverished or poor neighborhoods are much more prone to being victims than those who live in the wealthy neighborhoods. That doesn't mean that people, that wealthy people don't get, are not victims. That happens, but less often. So I was, last year as well, I was in Medellin, and I went to what is thought to be the most violent neighborhood in Medellin. And Medellin is the most violent city, or was the most violent city in Colombia. And Colombia was for many years the most violent country in the world. So in a way, at the time, during the 80s, 70s and 80s, that neighborhood that I visited was the most violent in the world. And I was talking with one victim. She had her husband killed. She had her daughter raped. And these are very crude details, and I apologize if this is too strong, but her story is just horrendous what happened to her. So that shows that she was much more prone to being a victim of crime because that's a very poor neighborhood. And she was, it's what we call in Colombia, a very humble person. So the people without all that many economic resources, we call them humble people. So mm-hmm. She didn't have that many economic resources. So she was much more unprotected than the others. That's the first thing. The second lesson that I learned is that victimization, or that type of victimization, can leave scars, and most often leaves scars in people's lives. So this happened in the 80s. What happened was that her husband went to work, and then on the way back, he was murdered. She was called, telling her that he had been murdered. She went to see if that was true. And in the meantime, the same people that killed the person went to her house and raped her daughter, and she came back and had two victims at the same time. And now, 20 or 20 something years later, she has many health problems, because what happens when you're a victim of crime, when you are living amidst violence, is that your body reacts. And that's what we call trauma. The body is always looking for danger, for sources of danger. And then you release many stress hormones. And that, of course, affects your body. She has now her neighborhood is peaceful. She's safe, but she's still living with the consequences of that victimization. So that would be the second lesson. The third lesson is that despite victimization, people can thrive. People can get back to life and enjoy life and get the happiness of life. So I interviewed her, but I also interviewed her daughter. And her daughter is a very, very happy person. She has a daughter herself. Mm-hmm. She works at a restaurant, and she receives me every time with a smile, with a lot of kindness. And that's something that I find a little bit paradoxical, that people who have suffered the most are often the most open and welcoming. So I could not believe, because they received me in their home. And I thought, well, you had your husband killed, this happened to you, and you trust a stranger, because I was a complete stranger to them. I just approached them and I asked, did you went through this? Yes, we went through this. I want to interview you. And they said, okay, you're welcome to our home. And I arrived there and they offered me a cup of coffee. So I think we have to understand those three lessons, that victimization is not equally distributed, that it's the poor and marginalized who are most often victimized, that victimization leaves a scar, and it's a difficult scar to deal with, but also that you can get over victimization. And many don't like the word victim. They prefer the word survivor, because they say this event do not define who I am. I am not a victim. I am a survivor of what happened to me.
You know, you mentioned about the victims. You know, here in the States, there's been some mass school shootings, Sandy Hook and Parkland, and parents of those students mm-hmm. and children that were killed have formed organizations to stop gun violence, and they've used that platform admirably to children's name to help their cause and push their cause. And I find that, as what you just said, never goes away, and it just shows that they persevere and they go through, hoping this doesn't happen to somebody else down the road. So it's I think that would be exactly the same thing here in the States, would that not?
Precisely. And I think that's an excellent example as well. Because as I said, criminologists research, what can we do about this? Should we punish? Should we use the prison? But there was also this criminologist from the US. His name was Hal Pepinski. And he said, we also have to believe in the power of peace and the power of reconciliation. So the more split a society is, the more violence you will have. And that's what we call the cascades of violence. So violence engenders violence. So we also have to believe in respect, in reconciliation. It's not about forgetting. It's not about denying what happened. It's about trying to build from what happened. So this example that you were mentioning, these are tragic events, and there's no way to deny that. But what we have to think is, how can we create a better society out of this? And that's a huge challenge mm-hmm. because these are very sad events, and it's not easy to be all that rational or all that empathetic. But if we take crime and we look at it and we try to understand, why did this happen and how can we make a better society, not keep throwing people to prison, because that has been demonstrated that it doesn't work. So how can we have a different society? How can we react differently to crime? And this sort of reactions that call for reconciliation, for peace, for living a different life, for being less violent, less aggressive, for not having a divided society, I think that's the way to go.
Excellent point. So when is your book going to be out for public? Will be able to be available to purchase.
That will be next year.
Okay.
So I'm still finalizing the book, it's a different style of writing, because as you can notice when I talk with you, I still tend to use some jargon and specialized language, because that's how I'm trained to think and write and talk as a criminologist to our scholars. But I think this is so important to tell our people why crime happens, why do people engage in crime. So I'm still working on it. I have this stipend, this scholarship, or this money that I got to mm-hmm. finish the book. I'm nearly there, and I'm always I always learn a lot from these conversations, because I also get to know what people find interesting. So all these questions that you're asking me, it's also a compass for me. This is what people want to understand. This is what people want to read. And then if I can use my experience and what I have studied to provide some answers, then that's what I want to do with this book.
Interesting. That's quite something. You know, I always watch, when I watch TV or watch the news or I read about a crime, it's like I always say, what the heck? I mean, how did that happen? And it's just mind-boggling sometimes, just some crimes. And I think sometimes too, we need to spend more time think about the victims as well, because I think sometimes the sensationalism of crimes, sometimes the victims in the aftermath of a crime are talked to, but then after that it fades away. But I think the victims, it's an ongoing sentence for them too, for the rest of their lives.
Indeed. And I think the TV, the movies, certain type of true crime podcasts, that's what we call popular criminology or pop criminology. That's how most people learn about crime. And those have two things in common. First, that they provide a very simplistic view of criminality. Often these TV shows or podcasts or movies, they portray those who commit crimes as just evil, evil people. And there are many books of that type. Mm-hmm. This person committed a crime because that person is evil. And that doesn't explain anything. And that's not true either. There are many theories that say they have something wrong in their wiring. You may have heard of this The Gene of Evil show on, I don't remember which channel that is, but they try to identify the gene that leads a person to commit a crime. And that has no scientific basis. So that's the first aspect that we have to be aware when we're looking at these shows, watching these shows. And the second one is what you thought. There are more parts in this phenomena than just the what people call the criminals. It's also about the victims, but it's also about society in general, because society as a whole is affected by crime, but society as a whole also has a responsibility and engenders crime. So my take on crime is that we are not detached from it. We are also helping to produce it as we support systems of injustice, inequality, poverty, exploitation. We are also fueling crime by our acts. So we cannot say I'm entirely innocent, because we are also part of society, and society has a big responsibility in crime. And then you also mentioned, well, when we see a crime, we only think about the criminals, but not the victims. And what I think is interesting as well is that often those who commit crimes are also victims. So it's not two completely different categories. Often they overlap. Often those who commit crimes are also victims and have victimized. And it's like this spiral where someone is victimized and then commits a crime and then it's victimized. So what the studies show is that most often the victims are also those who then commit crimes.
Well, David Goyes, I want to really thank you very much for coming on my podcast. You're in Bogota, Colombia, and I'm here in Memphis, Tennessee. I really appreciate you jumping on my podcast. You've definitely informed my audience about criminology and what your take is on it and your experience. And I want to thank you very much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.